This is the Africa service of Vatican Radio.
Welcome to our half-hour daily program for Africa.
In this edition today, our bulletin of church news that will be followed by Panorama and then our feature of justice and peace. Today we shall close with our sports roundup. My name is Kanyanta Godfrey Kampamba. Pope Francis on Tuesday made an appeal on behalf of those on the margins of medical attention and encouraged the faithful and people of goodwill to donate medicines to health charitable centers. His appeal came in his first Tuesday tweet, in which he announced the start of a period dedicated to collecting medicines for the pharmaceutical banks. From Tuesday 23rd February to 13th February begins the 23rd World Day of the Collection of Medicines for the Pharmaceutical Bank. You can go to the nearest pharmacy and donate some medicine to help some 1,800 charity and health assistance centers that care for 400,000 persons in poor health conditions, tweeted the Pope. His second Twitter message on Tuesday was a focus on the earthquake reality in Turkey and Syria. Pope Francis said that he remained close with all his heart to the people affected by the earthquake in Turkey and Syria. I continue to pray for those who have lost their lives, as well as the injured, family members and rescuers. May our concrete aid sustain them in the midst of this appalling tragedy, tweeted the Pope on Tuesday. In two separate telegrams on Monday, signed on his behalf by Vatican Secretary of State Cardinal Pietro Parolin, the Pope offered words of condolence and asked the Apostolic Nuncios Marek Sokzinski in Turkey and Mario Zenari in Syria to send his assurance of his spiritual closeness to all those affected. The Pope entrusted those who died to the loving mercy of the Almighty and sent his heartfelt condolences to those who mourn their loss. Likewise, he said, he prays that the emergency personnel will be sustained in their care of the injured and in the ongoing relief efforts by the divine gifts of fortitude and perseverance. The Pope also expressed a renewed sign of his spiritual solidarity for the long-suffering Syrian people. Turkey, which sits on the East Anatolian fault, is in one of the world's most volatile earthquake zones. Speaking to the media, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said that at least 2,800 buildings had collapsed. To make matters worse, a second earthquake struck in southeastern Turkey on Monday at lunchtime, with its epicenter around 8 miles from Gaziantep. Meanwhile, officials in Syria said at least 320 people are killed in the government-controlled areas, while rescue workers said at least 100 others died in rebel-controlled districts. Pope Francis, in his telegrams, said he was saddened by the huge loss of life caused by earthquakes in both Turkey and Syria. Pope Francis concluded his apostolic journey to South Sudan with the celebration of Holy Mass in Juba on Sunday. His visit ended the long-awaited and postponed journey with words of encouragement and hope for the suffering and war-ravaged people. In his farewell remarks, Pope Francis told them never to forget that Jesus knows their pain and loves them. Miklos Gustoni is a political analyst and humanitarian expert with many years of experience in South Sudan. Speaking to Vatican Radio, Gustoni looked back at the just-ended papal trip and the significance of the presence of the spiritual leaders in the world's youngest nation and about how the visit empowered civil society actors who have been struggling to get their voices heard in the country and beyond.
I especially like the fact that, you know, the Pope canceled his trip to South Sudan last year due to health reasons, and perhaps the political elite in South Sudan thought that they would encounter a Pope who would be very frail and who would just, you know, go on a spiritual mission without getting involved in some of the toughest parts of politics. And if that's what they expected, they were absolutely wrong, because what we could see during his three-day visit is that he was absolutely on top of raising some of the critical issues that the country is facing from a political point of view. So I think in many ways I felt that the Pope thought of this trip as a way of holding leaders accountable for not having lived up to their commitment that they made to him when they visited the Vatican in 2019 and he shockingly kissed their feet, and they didn't live up to that. And I think that the key message that was sent by the three spiritual leaders who were on this trip.
On the return flight from South Sudan, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, and the moderator of the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland, Reverend Ian Greenshields, joined Pope Francis for an in-flight press conference. The three church leaders jointly answered questions put to them by journalists covering the apostolic journey to the Democratic Republic of Congo and to South Sudan. One of the questions came from Jean-Luc Motosami from Mauritius and covering also for South Sudanese Radio, which is exiled in Nairobi. He wanted to know why, after decades of the presence of two United Nations missions in both the Democratic Republic of Congo and South Sudan, violence keeps spreading. He asked the three leaders how, as one, they can help in recommending a new model of intervention, given the growing temptation of many disappointed African nations to choose other partners for their security partners. In response to the question, Reverend Ian Greenshields spoke of persuasion and dialogue as the best remedy to help overcome divisions and wars in both countries.
I think one of the issues that comes to mind with respect to this is the high degree of illiteracy that exists within countries, in which case people don't have a clear understanding of who they are and where they are and making educated choices. That's one thing. We certainly have to challenge the arms race, where people make more money through that in the world than probably anything else. How we do that is through persuasion, and how we overcome division is through dialogue. I want to just give you one small story about Scotland, the country that I come from, which was religiously a deeply divided country, where we had terrible things happening, terrible violence, terrible division within our nation. There then began a process of dialogue between ourselves, the Church of Scotland, and the Catholic Church in Scotland, that arrived at the point last year where we signed a declaration of friendship, where we would walk together in our differences, but also in agreement with the things that we agree with. And it's only when you can get to that stage of dialogue and encounter with the other person that you start to bring down those walls. And that's what we've noticed in Scotland, in what, when I was young, was a deeply divided country, and is changing. And education, too, helps to do that.
On Tuesday, 7th February 2023, the world celebrates the Safer Internet Day. This is the annual flagship campaign to raise awareness of the importance of staying safe online. The theme of the Safer Internet Day this year is Together for a Better Internet, and calls upon all stakeholders to join together to make the Internet a safe and better place for all, and especially for children and young people. Commemorating the Safer Internet Day, the United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, is calling for concerted action in order to prevent bullying and harassment for the over 70% of young people online worldwide. 30 years after the adoption of the Convention on the Rights of the Child and the creation of the World Wide Web, it's time for renewed focus on children's digital rights, says UNICEF. You are tuned to the Daily Africa Service of Vatican Radio.
African News Panorama.
A new UN report says the global epicenter of violent Islamic extremism is sub-Saharan Africa, where people are increasingly joining because of economic factors and less for religious ones. The report by the UN's International Development Agency, UNDP, found that 25% of voluntary recruits to such groups cited job opportunities as their primary reason for joining, while 17% cited religious ideas. At the same time, half of the respondents said there was a tipping point that pushed them to join, such as the killing or arrest of family members by state security forces. Over 2,000 people were interviewed for the report in 8 African countries: Burkina Faso, Cameroon, Chad, Mali, Niger, Nigeria, Somalia, and Sudan. The report says security-driven counter-terrorism responses are often costly and minimally effective rather than a militarized approach. The report recommended greater investment in child welfare, education, and quality livelihoods to counter and prevent violent extremism. A judge in Kenya has ruled that Meta, the parent company of Facebook, can be sued in the East African country. A former Facebook moderator in Kenya is suing the company, claiming poor working conditions. Daniel Motong said that while working as a moderator in Facebook's Africa Hub in Nairobi, he was exposed to gruesome content such as rape, torture, and beheadings that risked his and his colleagues' mental health. Meta tried to have the case dropped, arguing that Kenyan courts do not have jurisdiction over their operations, but a labor court judge dismissed that in a ruling on Monday. The next step in the case will be considered by the Nairobi court on the 8th of March. Amnesty International in Kenya has hailed the ruling as historic, adding that this is a significant step that ensures the authority of Kenyan courts to protect and enforce fundamental human rights. Meta is facing a separate court case in which 2 Ethiopians say hate speech was allowed and even promoted on Facebook amid heated rhetoric over their country's deadly conflict in the Tigray region. A high court in Malawi has lifted the government's suspension of the head of the country's anti-corruption body, Martha Chizuma, paving the way for her return to work. The chief of the Anti-Corruption Bureau of Malawi was suspended last week in relation to a lawsuit against her following a leaked audio in which she allegedly made remarks suggesting that a number of senior government officials and some judicial officers were hindering the fight against corruption. You're tuned to the Africa Service of Vatican Radio.
And now our feature, Justice and Peace. In this edition, we report on the efforts of a youth movement in Ghana, known as 350 Ghana, Reducing Our Carbon. The movement is educating people about environmental protection and campaigning against government projects that damage the environment. Its head is Kibeze Ezekiel, who in 2020 won the Goldman Environmental Prize for Africa. This program was prepared and presented by Zach Cornfield and Ned Fulmer, who are members of an environmental campaigning group known as the Try Guys, who collaborate with the United Nations News Center. Mr. Kibeze and his group have inspired many people to organize and fight for positive change.
We got wind that the coal plant was going to be sited somewhere in the western region of Ghana.
To Chibeze, a coal plant didn't make any sense. There's no coal in Ghana.
So in addition to the new plant, they'd have to build a port just for importing coal from South Africa?
That would endanger the local marine ecosystem and fishing economy, not to mention the effects of burning coal, the world's most polluting form of power generation.
We moved to the community. We spoke to the chiefs, the elders, the women groups, the youth groups, to educate them on the impact of coal plant. So we did all this behind the scenes, which we call the submarine approach, because it was a quiet approach, you know, where we're not making noise.
Chibeze spoke with one queen mother. That's a really high-ranking female leader in Ghana, who'd heard that in another community, their rainwater had become contaminated by a similar project. People had broken out in rashes. She was worried that could happen to her community.
She doesn't know what this coal plant is all about. So the question is, did government really do any serious engagement? So all those things became our ammunition in fighting the campaign.
It seemed like the government hadn't gotten any buy-in from local leaders, despite being required to consult with the community on projects like this.
You said that you have gone to engage NGOs and people in the community. Okay, as a matter of transparency and accountability, publish the list of the people you engage so we can be sure that the people were fully engaged. To date, that information has not been made available.
Chibeze's group continued to build a movement educating people about the danger of coal and the value of renewable energy.
They got youth activists together for marches with protesting and dancing.
The best kind. Eventually, it was too much heat. Plans for the coal plant were canceled.
And the government made a larger commitment to only build renewable energy facilities going forward.
All because one person had his eye on the ball.
Here's more of our conversation with Chibeze Ezekiel. He spoke with our producer, Rachel Ward.
As part of our argument, what we said was that economically, it may be cheap to generate energy through coal, but there are other externalities. Because one, when coal plants are working, they emit gas into the atmosphere, and that could lead to air pollution. That could also lead to respiratory problems that people will suffer from. And that means that it's going to affect the budget or the Ministry of Health because they must respond to somebody's health consequences. So that's the cost element. So when they say it is cheap, what do they mean by it being cheap? So it is not cheap in the sense that they are trying to portray it. Again, we live in a country where communities live on water bodies, you know, for cooking, for domestic stuff. So if we end up depositing the coal ash into the water bodies, then what are we doing to the people who depend on the water bodies? These all have cost implications because we must get money to address the waste and sanitation problems. So again, it's not cheap, which they are failing to recognize.
It's always so surprising when people don't consider all of the factors around a decision. It just seems so obvious when you're looking at it from the perspective of the community of people who are actually going to experience the effects. Were there other incentives that the government was considering as part of the reason to build the coal plant? Like, I guess getting a coal plant online would be fast, but were there other reasons why it was appealing?
It was only two main reasons why government opted for coal plant. One, because it was cheaper to generate energy. And number two, that it creates employment for young people.
And then the work that you did was to get out and talk to people about the sort of counter argument to those two rationales. What did that actually look like? You're going out to talk to people. Were there any moments that like particularly stand out for you where things went really well or maybe things didn't go as well as you wanted them to?
We have two plans in a community. The first one was to go to the communities to introduce ourselves officially to the chiefs and the elders and tell them why we are in a community. That, okay, we've heard that government wants to build a coal plant, but we have come to educate them on a coal plant. So we agree on a day that we can come back to the community and then we can organize a workshop or a conference and use audiovisuals, you know, or videos so that they can see, you know, what coal plant is doing in other countries. And then after agreeing on a day and a time, we travel back to Accra. And whilst we were preparing to come back to the community to hold that workshop, we got a call that the police stormed the house, that he's leading a certain group of people in a community. And that should we come to the community, then we stand, we are arrested. But actually, we were prepared. For us, it would have even enhanced our campaign. What would have been our crime? Is it a crime to educate chiefs and elders on environmental issues? These are young people who are doing education on environment. You know, so for us, it was even a blessing in disguise.
Right, because of the publicity would wind up presumably getting you more attention and support.
So we are actually getting ready to be arrested for the first time in my life. So we're actually in the process of traveling back to the community only for the Minister of Environment to announce publicly that government is no more going to build a coal plant. So we couldn't go back to the community because actually there was no need at that time.
So you didn't get to be arrested.
Yes.
Like maybe a little disappointed.
Yes.
Well, I'm glad that you weren't arrested. And I'm also glad that you guys won.
Thank you.
One of the things that I think is so impressive about this campaign is that in 2015, the government is announcing we're going to build a coal plant. And then in 2017, the president is saying we're only going to use renewables from here on out. Obviously, your campaign seems to have been really effective, but what else changed in order to get the government to commit to only building new renewable facilities?
We went all out, you know, because I recall even one government official, you know, calling me that they've seen our campaigns on social media and all that, you know, trying to put pressure on government and that, you know, we are rather promoting renewable energy. Government is party to the Sustainable Development Goals, you know, Goal 7 talks about clean and affordable energy.
Sorry, let me just fill in a gap here. So for people who aren't familiar, Goal 7 of the SDGs are the UN's Sustainable Development Goals, and Goal 7 is ensure access to affordable, reliable, sustainable, and modern energy for all.
So we need to hold government accountable to respond or do things in line with Goal 7 of the SDGs. So we have all these instruments that we capitalize on to really remind government, make sure you meet those pledges. And one of the things we used again was that government was in Paris, you know, the Paris Climate Agreement when it was signed. So the question is, how can you go to Paris, you know, the COP, sign an agreement and come back home and say you want to build a coal plant? I mean, it was inconsistent. It was illogical. So I think that those were some of the forces we used, you know, against government, and they had to backtrack on their coal plant. And we kept shouting, we kept campaigning that renewable energies are better. So if you look at the cost-benefit analysis, they realize that, okay, it is still possible to consider renewable energy in the context of their government's obligation at a global level and Africa level, and also as a way to promote clean energy development.
So in 2015, there was the crisis where power was intermittent, and then there was the proposal, and then your campaign was successful. How is the demand for energy working out now? What's the status of things these days?
In terms of our energy mix, renewable energy is still 1% or below 1%, not very impressive. We are still relying more on thermal plants and some bits and pieces of hydro. We are hoping that in a few years to come, we're going to increase, you know, renewable energy development and upskilling in Ghana. There are still some bottlenecks that we need to address as a country. That said, there are some private sector operators on their own are shifting to renewable energy, having done their cost-benefit analysis. Because one, if it depends on the state, we're not too sure of the power reliability. And that is not sustainable for business operators. And therefore, they want to put in place measures that can guarantee them some constant power supply over a long period of time. So I have seen some companies who have solar energy on their building so that they can go off the national grid. They can save some cost. There's one shopping mall in Ghana, just to give a quick example, that runs completely on solar energy and 1.5 megawatts. So for them, that's power reliability. So a shop owner who rents a shop knows that, okay, at least my power is guaranteed. So those are some of the things we are seeing, some innovative ways people are going, you know, some are using biofuel, biomass, different renewable energy sources to have their own power generated and not only rely on the national grid. So I think that with time, in the next 2 or 3 years, we're going to have some impressive increment in renewable energy usage in Ghana than we have today.
Kibeze Ezekiel, the head of the 350 Ghana Reducing Our Carbon Movement, speaking there to Rachel Ann Cole, the executive producer of the United Nations Affiliated Environmental Campaigners, the Try Guys. And that was Justice and Peace for this week. This has been Johnny Baptist Tumusime.
This is a sports roundup, and welcome to the program. My name is Kenyatta Godfrey Kampamba. The anti-doping agency of Kenya, ADAC, has sanctioned two athletes over various offenses as the country steps up effort in the fight against drug cheats. Gloria Kite, a 5,000-meter specialist who represented Kenya at last year's World Championships, has been suspended for 2 years for the presence of anabolic androgenic steroids. At the same time, marathoner Stella Basosio, who won the 2021 Rotterdam Marathon, has also been sanctioned for the same period of time after testing positive for trimetazidine. According to the anti-doping agents of Kenya, Kite's sample was found positive, and her explanation that it was from medication given to her in hospital held no water. The anti-doping watchdog said that Kite sought medication from a hospital and the medication she was given contained banned substances and she had not sought therapeutic use exemption. Meanwhile, Marathon Abasosio also tested positive under similar circumstances, and according to her explanation, supported by the doctor who treated her, she was diagnosed with muscle spasm and soft tissue injury and administered some drugs. But according to Anti-Doping Kenya, although she disclosed the medication she was using at the material time in her doping control form, she did not seek therapeutic use exemption. Malawi National Council of Sports has banned Athletics Association of Malawi President Godfrey Piri and General Secretary Frank Chitembea from taking part in, participating in and organizing any athletic events in the country. A statement from the country's sports governing body, mandated by the laws of Malawi, the council has already notified World, Continental and Regional Athletics governance bodies, notifying them to cease and desist from dealing with these individuals. The Malawi Sports Council has announced that a caretaker committee led by Justice Kalembera has been appointed and will run the affairs of the national sports till matters are resolved, hopefully soon enough. Sources within the Malawi Athletics Association has been complaining that the association's leadership had overstayed and that they were completely ignoring Sports Council, citing government interference as justification for their defiance. Former Ghana Black Stars player Christian Asu has been found alive in the rubble of the residential building he was in when the earthquake caused it to collapse. The former Malaga, Porto and Newcastle player is one of the few survivors found alive among the rubble of the earthquake that hit Turkey and Syria, causing more than 2,500 deaths so far. According to Ebola, a Portuguese football publication, the now Hatayspor footballer who disappeared among the ruins of the earthquake in the city of Hatay is in the hospital, injured in his right foot and having difficulty breathing. And on that note, we come to the end of today's edition of our Sports Roundup. Until next week, at the same time, my name is Kanyanta Godfrey Kampamba. This is the Africa Service of Vatican Radio. Praised be Jesus Christ. Laudetur Jesus Christus.